Monster House presents.
Monster Talk is an independent podcast production of Monster House, LLC. You can show your support by subscribing to our ad-free extended episodes at patreon.com/monstertalk. We want to grow our Monster Talk audience, and the easiest way to accomplish that is for listeners to leave us 5-star reviews on iTunes. Rating us on iTunes is great, but positive reviews have a huge impact and only take a moment. Today's episode is brought to you by Audible. Audible is offering Monster Talk listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audibletrial.com/monstertalk and look through their incredible collection for your selection. Download and start listening on your phone, computer, or tablet. That's audibletrial.com/monstertalk.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith. As you may recall, I was running a GoFundMe to raise money to get new artwork for the Monster Talk website. Thanks to your generous donations, and especially to one, oh my gosh, really generous anonymous donor, we are fully funded, and I'm working with the artist now to get our art together. So thank you for everyone who contributed, and especially to that someone who contributed such a large amount. Your support is humbling and amazing, and I'm just overwhelmed.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
When I was a kid, a teacher told me that it's really important to have strong abstract thinking skills. It's funny because she told me that, but didn't clearly explain what abstract thinking means. When I tried to look it up, I ran into abstract art, things like Picasso's Cubism, and suddenly felt perplexed as to how this kind of thing could possibly be useful. But later, as I embarked on a variety of creative endeavors, I realized that abstraction is the ability to model the real world in ways that allow us to better understand it. Writing's a form of abstraction. Painting, sculpture, computer programming, mathematics, acting, gaming. These are all ways of modeling the real and toying with it in sometimes unreal ways. I've become increasingly convinced that if anything makes us special as a species in the world, it's our ability to think abstractly and model a variety of outcomes or variants on a theme so that we can better understand the real world. Art, if it seeks to emulate or comment on the real world, relies not only on the abstract thinking of the artist, but upon each observer's own mindset. Some works of art lurk around us, affecting our sense of place in ways we might not even be aware of. They can bring us unease or comfort, or any of the hues of the colorless spectrum that paints our emotions. We talked about gargoyles way back in episode 153 with Matthew Duman. He's expanded his work in documenting the numerous works of art that adorn Gothic campus architecture in a new book called The Grotesque Ten. I've put some images from the book in the show notes. Please have a look. I think he's proved that playing Bela Lugosi is Dead on repeat is not the only way to bring Gothic into your living room. Before we hop into this interview, I want to bring to your attention the first of several new projects that I've been working on in pretty much every spare moment for the past couple of years. None of these projects are going to take me away from Monster Talk, but they do let me expand on some of my other passions. The first is a new horror podcast, which I've cleverly titled The Horror Podcast. You can find it at thehorrorpod.com or at patreon.com/thehorrorpodcast. As I record this, it's just been released into iTunes. You should be able to find a link in our website in the show notes or at Patreon or in your iTunes or in your podcast aggregator of choice. Hopefully, very soon it will show up on Spotify, Pandora, and all the other outlets that people like to listen to shows on. Another project I've been working on will be announced during episode 200. That project will be more directly related to the subject matter of that particular episode, and I'm very excited about it. But that's all I have to say about that right now. Stay tuned. Oh, and coming up in episode 199 is our coverage of Ouija boards. I thought about delaying that until October, but it's been delayed far too long already and needs to get out of its box and see some daylight. I'm trying to get this episode out so that I can head down to DragonCon 2019, where I'll be moderating an interesting panel on Saturday about horror movies based on allegedly true stories. And then on Sunday, I'll be in the horror track on multiple panels around folk horror, one-shot slasher movies, and, you'll love this, Bigfoot horror movies. Those should all be fun. I hope you can make it if you're down here. And next weekend, I will be attending CryptidCon in Kentucky, in Lexington. They didn't bring me on as a panelist this year, but Jeb Card and I will be lurking around and enjoying the cryptid ambiance. And if you're in Lexington and are making it to CryptidCon, I hope we get to meet. All right, well, that's enough shop talk. It's time to now talk about all these strange and monstrous faces leering at us from the peaks and angles of this mysterious Gothic architecture. Please do check out the show notes because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words of
Monster Talk.
Today we welcome back Matthew Duman, a photographer and graphic designer who grew up in Bethany, Connecticut. He attended the Gargoyle Free Campus of Central Connecticut State University, but while studying abroad, developed a fascination with the grotesque sculptures of the cathedrals of Britain. He joined us last year for episode 153 on gargoyles and now has a new book called Grotesque 10, which highlights the Gothic art features of 10 campuses around America with stunning photographs that take you up close to these amazing works of craftsmanship. Welcome back to Monster Talk, Matthew.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So I kind of think I know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What led you to do this follow-up book to your Gargoyles book?
Well, for the previous book, the one about Yale, to promote it, I was doing a lot of lectures and things at libraries and different organizations. And a lot of lectures that I gave, after the lecture, people would raise their hand or come up to me and say, you know, you should go to this campus, you should go to Duke, you should go to Princeton, you know, there's great stuff there. And it really, after a while, it really got to me. I'm like, you know, I'm missing out on a lot of things. I decided right then and there that I would visit these campuses.
So you've got the University of Pennsylvania, Northwestern yep. University. And so this is my ignorance, but can you kind of fill in the state for these? So obviously University of Pennsylvania is Pennsylvania. Northwestern University, is that Illinois?
Yes.
Okay. And then Duke University?
Yep, North Carolina.
North Carolina. And Princeton University?
Yep, New Jersey.
You probably didn't know you were going to get quizzed, did you? Washington University in St. Louis is right there. Yep. And then you got Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. And the yep. University of Chicago, which I believe is also in Illinois.
What?
Yeah. The City College of New York, which I'm going to go with New York?
Yes, I think so.
Awesome. Okay. Oh, this is like a bar trivia thing.
Just don't ask me the capitals of these things.
No. We'll leave that for the sixth graders. Is Bryn Mawr College? Is that right?
Bryn Mawr.
Bryn Mawr.
And that's in Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania as well. Oh, that's right. Okay. Actually, when I saw that, I did a little reading about it. And then you've got Yale University.
Yes.
Which is?
In Connecticut. That's the closest one to me.
Yeah. No, I just was thinking back on our conversation from before. That's so cool.
Okay. Well, see, Yale, with the other book, I wanted to include Yale in this one, but I didn't want to repeat myself.
Right.
Luckily, between the time my old book and my new book, Yale opened up two new residence colleges built in the collegiate Gothic style just 2 years ago. So it was good fortune for me, all new grotesques.
I think, you know, if people haven't heard the Gargoyle episode, again, that's episode 153, I do encourage people to go check it out. And I'll also mention the Gargoyle book, which we'll put a link to in the show notes, as well as your new book. I've been doing Monster Talk, it'll be 10 years in July. And in all that time, Your book is the only book that my wife, the lovely Mrs. Dr. Atlantis, has stolen from me.
Really?
Yeah, and keeps in her book collection. What a compliment. Yeah, no, for real, it is. Yeah, she absolutely, she said, I have to have this, and off she went with it. So, yeah. So I imagine when we get the physical copy, she hasn't asked for the PDF, but when I get when I get the actual copy of your grotesque book, I think she'll really like that as well. It's really, really cool.
This one has, the new one has over 500 images.
Yeah.
And 300 pages. And I each one of those images I edited myself and many times and to bring out the highlights and the dark and the shadows and all that.
How long were you collecting these photos? You were just talking to me a year ago about the other book. So,
Well, I've been working on this one for the past, I don't know, five years or so. It was really started out. I was when I could get time off to go travel to these places.
Yeah.
And then once I would get a thousand or so images from each place. Then I had to go through and edit it and try to pick out ones that I really liked and that had meaning. And then I didn't really know of any book that was similar to this. So I had to kind of feel out how to structure the book. And all that took a lot of time.
Well, I like the way you've got it laid out. It's just gorgeous photography. And it also reminded me of some of my ignorance. So I always like to learn new things.
How do you mean?
You don't know what you don't know until you run into it, right? So Gothic architecture, you talk a little bit about this in the written portion of the book. I realize it's a lot of photographs, but you do have written portions as well. Can you talk about this Gothic architecture in American colleges and why that became a thing? Because I think I had thought that it was always like that, and that's not really the case exactly. So,
well, back in the 19th century, about the mid-19th century, the American colleges, they really didn't have the cultural status that they enjoy today and the nostalgia that people put on them. Back then, they were just seen as kind of like factories to produce people trained to be a doctor or a lawyer or a priest or something. They didn't have much cultural clout. So, and that meant, well, and plus they were pretty poor as well. So a big reason why they adopted the they revived the Gothic architectural style is actually money when you get down to it. They revived the style to create an unspoken connection with the medieval universities of Europe, like Oxford or Cambridge. And this elevated the status of American schools and in turn their endowments and the donations they got as well.
Yeah. Wait, I couldn't get the mute turned off. Sorry there. There was a particular phrase you used that I really liked a lot. Let me see if I can find it right quick. I should have cut it and pasted it into my doc. But you basically talked about how that the Gothic architecture gave the campuses a sort of a gravity, that they didn't have otherwise, which I
thought an air of tradition and permanence.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it's effective, and I can tell you how effective it is because I went to so I do a lot of research, and sometimes there's rare books I want to look at for preparing this show. And one time I couldn't get one from the interlibrary loan system. So I had to drive up into the mountains of Tennessee to a little college up there, and beautiful Gothic architecture all over the campus. But it turns out that even though it looks like it's, 200 years old, it's not. It's exactly tying into this sort of this tradition of late 19th, early 20th century Gothic architecture. And there's schools around here that also have that. And I love it, though, because growing up, when I see those schools, I always feel like they have this like an intellectual weight to them. They've like they seem like they've been around forever.
And not only they have they been around for forever, by extension, you think they will be around forever.
Yes.
In the future.
It's really impressive. But, you know, the Gothic architecture is really not complete without these grotesques and gargoyles. So let's...
Yes, that's my favorite part of
it. Yeah. So what... Can we talk about where you found the most interesting pieces? I mean, you had to make a lot of selections. Obviously, you couldn't include everything. So how did you decide what to include?
Well, I tried to pick ones that I could actually say something about. I didn't want to – when you start something like this, the tendency is just to throw stuff in that looks neat, and I didn't want to do that. And so I wanted to – predominantly, most of my images, because I had something to say about them or they had some significance. And that's mainly how I made the decision. But I wanted to choose images that I could actually say something about that had some significance to either the architecture or the school. And that's what really dictated what I put in.
There's something fascinating about the disparity of seeing this Gothic art style representing modernity. You've got cases where people are driving cars or using the phonograph. Yes. You know, that's so interesting.
There's one at the New Colleges at Yale, and it's kind of a series, and it kind of depicts the history of the written word, and it has like an old stone tablet, and then it has a scroll, and then it has a medieval book, and then it has a modern book, and then it has an electronic tablet, like an iPad.
Oh, really? That's so cool. Yeah.
And that was just done a few years, like 2 years ago.
Well, you actually had another written chapter talking about reconciling the different architectural styles.
Yeah, I found that very interesting at Yale, what they did at one point. They had this one residential college. Basically, a residential college is a really well-appointed dorm, a multi-building dorm that's all connected. And it has all the amenities and everything. And this Davenport College, it's called... It's built in the Georgian style from late 18th century England, and it surrounds a courtyard. But the front building fronts out onto York Street, and then all the buildings around it are collegiate Gothic. So what they did was the whole Davenport College is done in the Georgian style, except for the facade of the front building, and the front facade of that building at Davenport College is the collegiate Gothic style. So it's in harmony with the other colleges down the street, but you go through the tunnel and out into the courtyard, and you're in the Georgian world.
There you go. So it's just like like everybody wants, with Gothic in the front, Georgian in the back. Maybe nobody wants that, but there it is. It looks cool. Your photography there is really neat in the book because you're showing, you can tell it's basically the same building, but you're seeing the two different sides of it. So speaking of Gothic architecture, this is not covered in your book. Your book is dealing with these campuses, but did you have any observations about the recent Notre Dame fire in Paris? I know that when people think about this kind of architecture, that's one of the go-to places where you see gargoyles and that sort of ornate, external structure. And it was really heartbreaking to see it burning.
Yeah. I was devastated when I first heard about that and heard it was still burning for a long period of time. Because from when I was a kid, I mean, there are many Gothic cathedrals in Europe, but that's the most iconic for me. And that's whenever you say a Gothic cathedral, that's immediately what I think of. And yeah, I wasn't too happy about that. And I kept waiting for them to say, well, it was just a small fire and we put it out, but it went on for a while. And, from what I've read, not a lot of the grotesques were damaged in any big degree from what I hear. And I heard that they actually are going to remove them and go back and rebuild and then put the grotesque back.
Oh, so, wow. Okay.
So, yeah. So hopefully not too many of them were damaged, because I know they, you know, the ones made of stone, they can't burn, but they still can be damaged from the heat.
And all the
acidity and all that other stuff. So
the history and the artistry and the fact that it took hundreds of years to build. And I mean, now theoretically it could be built faster, but even the cathedrals in America, are slow. I mean, it's just it's like you may be able to put things back fast in a modern way, but I'm just not so sure how quickly they can do that. And I know people are pledging lots of money and that sort of thing, but it's still tragic to see that kind of history disappearing.
Oh, yeah.
So, or being damaged, even if it doesn't disappear.
Because even with the grotesques and gargoyles there, I mean, a big reason why I'm so into this is because they're kind of, you know, they're messages from the past.
Yeah.
That go through time. And now the colleges that I did in America are, you know, the oldest ones are, you know, 100, 200 years old. But when you talk about cathedrals like Notre Dame, that's a whole... They're a lot older, it's a lot more of a loss.
It is. But I think the things that are, you know, built in stone here have a good chance of lasting a long time. So I think one of the things that I like about your book is that I can't afford to go to all these campuses and walk around and look at the architecture. And my personal experience is when I was in college, I didn't have time to really take that stuff in either. I didn't have time to really walk around and look at the architecture and, you know, look at all the little details, because I was busy trying to finish my coursework.
Yeah. Well, what I found when I go to these campuses, and even at Yale, is a lot of people, even be they students or professor or faculty members or just people that live in the area, a lot of people just don't look up and see these sculpture.
Yeah. Yeah. At least now people usually have a camera with them all the time. Well, 'cause Oglethorpe is our big Gothic architecture here in the Atlanta area. And it's got, for years they did the Shakespeare Festival there. So you'd be in this sort of Gothic architectural milieu. And then there would be this outdoor theater, for the Shakespeare plays, which was great. It really added to the
experience. Yeah, with the atmosphere. Of
yeah,
the whole
so that was really nice. But alas, that has stopped. The college is still there, but the Shakespeare Festival's discontinued.
Well, when I went to these campuses and I talked to people and I showed them what I found on their own campus, and a lot of times they were amazed. And now I'm not saying I have any superpower, and actually I wear glasses, so it's more my mindset, because I'm new to these places. So I'm taking in every detail. When you live and work at a place for a long period of time, you kind of skip over the detail and take it for granted. And it takes you going to a new place to really take something in to a big extent. And that's what I found.
The imagery, it reminds me that, like, it's actually, with a lot of the 3D printing techniques and some other things going on, it would be really pretty easy to make these sort of grotesque figures for your own house. You could probably, you know, render them in 3D and then, like, make a cast of it and then pour it in concrete or something like that. I don't know how you'd mount it on the wall. I guess you could put bolts into it. But, I mean, it would be a very trivial thing to sort of put small versions of these around the house. I think I might look into that. That would be really cool,
yeah.
Especially inside the house. You reminded me of that because you have these – you included the sort of end-of-the-pew architecture. Are those still called grotesques when they're sort of – put on the end of pews in armrests?
there probably is a more technical name. I use grotesque in a very, very broad sense to mean any sculpted decoration on or in a building. So I included, and I included those because I like them as well.
Yeah, no, and they remind me of so much M.R. James. The imagery shows up in his ghost stories, sometimes very critically. Was it the Stalls of Barchester, I think, is one?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't want to misquote, but I think that's correct. And it's that kind of feature that adds that sort of, well, it adds gothic atmosphere, quite literally, to the experience of going there. It's very neat. And the photographs you have are just, it probably sounds like I'm just trying to sell your book, but I really did like it a lot. So,
well, I had photographed the outside. This is at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. And somebody told me afterwards that there's some great things inside the chapel there. So I had to get in contact with the chaplain and go through the public relations office. And the only stipulations they had was whenever I refer to Trinity College in the book, it wasn't Trinity College. It was Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut.
Ah, well, there you go.
And then they wanted to see the book before it went to press.
Right.
But other than that, and then they did, and they had one change, and that's it. So, but it's interesting that you bring up M.R. James, because I had read some of his stories a while ago. I looked into his life, and he very much exemplified what collegiate Gothic wants to convey. Because he was a lifelong academic, and he was provost he was a student and then a provost at Eton and then at Cambridge as well, and so he really exemplified those pious academic values that collegiate Gothic architecture wants to convey.
Absolutely, he did. Yeah, he. I think he might not. I mean, I know he liked to tell stories and teach and be a part of that college atmosphere. But I get the impression he also really, really enjoyed doing that sort of archivist work around going into old book collections and figuring out what was there and, you know, making lists and indexing and just doing that kind of research.
And finding obscure things. So. And also, if you look at the years from his birth to his death, he was born in 1862 and died in 1936. That's roughly about the time collegiate Gothic architecture was popular in America.
Wow. That's so he kind of end-capped it, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. That's neat. Now, I noticed just in the text, you mentioned that one of the colleges is known as the Hogwarts of New York.
And City College of New York.
I thought that was really funny. Did you, or are there any other sort of interesting nicknames or that kind of trivia or that sort of fact around these colleges that are worth mentioning while we're together here?
Well, there's a lot. Yeah, when you look into the architecture and the history of these schools, it turns up a lot of related topics and personal dramas. And like at the City College of New York, those original buildings were built in the very early 1900s, like 1904, 1905. And I was looking at the sculpture. I'm like, wow, it looks in really good condition to be well over 100 years old. And then I did some research and it turns out, well, those aren't the originals.
Oh, really?
Yes. Back in the early 1900s, when they did all this, they sculpted the grotesques and they made them out of terracotta and then they covered them with a thick glossy glaze. And then from the beginning, no one liked the glossy finish. So they had them sandblasted. Wow. Now, no one knew this at the time, but the sandblasting created all these little mini cracks in the finish. And that allowed moisture to get in. And there was freezing and thawing.
And thawing. And yeah, yeah. Cracks.
And then by the time, about the 60s and the 70s, a lot of the grotesques were falling off the buildings. So yikes. In the 80s, they took them all down, recast them, and put them in of this more durable material and put them up. And then they put the old ones in storage. And then I saw an article that some of them were dumped somewhere on the City College of New York campus. And it said by the architecture building. So I looked up the architecture building. It's called Spitzer School of Architecture. And then I found it on Google Maps and zoomed way down on it. And you could see on one side of the building, there's all these little white blotches. And then I went down there, and there's about 60 grotesques just thrown into the grass right by a parking lot. So it's kind of like a grotesque graveyard.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. It's funny. I have that a little panorama of all the old grotesques, and I kind of skillfully cropped it out. But just to the left of the one, all the way to the left, is the if I would have went just a little more, you could see the you would have seen the back bumper of a car backed up to it.
That's so neat. I like. There's so many cool images in here. You have there's skeletons and drinking people and these sort of there's people who look like they might be based on real people. People who are clearly in animals. I don't know. I've ever seen anything with this many images of American grotesques. It's just, I think this is a must have if you like this sort of architectural feature.
This is, and it basically is just something that I was really interested in, and I just kind of followed it to I'm not going to say conclusion, but I followed it out. And
well, I know my wife's going to like
what I ended up with.
Yeah, but I mean, when I think about people say coffee table books, but it's the kind of thing you could put in your house and somebody could pick it up. And any time you pick it up, you're going to find something interesting to look at. It's definitely
not something you read once and put away.
Right, right. No, I always remind my kids when I get a chance, when I go to places where they have paintings up, I'll start staring at the paintings. And I'm just inclined to look at stuff, right? And my wife and children sometimes are like, why do you keep staring at it? Like, because I always see something different, right? And I think before television, when people put up art, it wasn't necessarily just to show, like we do a lot of, I think what you would say, cultural signaling with art. You put up things about, these are the things I'm interested in. These are the bands I like, or, these are movies I
this
like.
This is part of my identity.
Right. But a lot of art, I think, can be, expressing multiple ideas. And it's really fun to sort of imagine, what did the artist think? And, what does the context of it mean? And I think there's just a lot going on there. Beyond, you're walking past a building that's got some stuff on it.
In the book, I kind of break the types of grotesques up into by their subject matter. I call them breeds of grotesque. And at first, I was going to call them species of grotesque. And I was going to make up all these Latin names and stuff, and I was really into it. And then I realized, well, that analogy is kind of flawed, because the scientific definition of a species is that they can't
breed.
Different species cannot produce offspring.
Yeah.
So that's why I changed it to breeds, because different breeds of animal reproduce all the time, like mixed breed dogs or cats. And because these grotesques, they might look, you can look at them many times and see many different shades of meaning in them.
Exactly. Well, is there anything else you'd like to say about it, or anything, any images you'd like to talk about a little bit?
The one I have on the cover, originally I was going to have just kind of a collage of all these different small images. And then I was looking at them like, I really think I want something that gets your attention from far away.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what's better than a big face?
Yeah.
So, and this one, that's at the University of Pennsylvania in their huge residential quadrangle.
And you mentioned the size in the text. How big is that?
Yeah, because that's another thing about it. It's over 4 feet tall and mounted on a wall in a tunnel. And if you can probably see in the photo, there's these like kind of iron bars that are coming out from the sides of it.
Yep.
And it's kind of cropped off, but they meet in the center right in front of the face, and there's kind of a lantern or a lamp. And I kept thinking, you know, seeing that face, I mean, I was there in the daytime, but if you come back late at night and you see that face under harsh light, that's pretty unsettling.
Yeah, yeah. Giant 4-foot leering. Yeah, absolutely.
And then there's little strange faces on either side of it as well.
It makes me want to go back to college, but a different college.
Well, yeah, that's because you were saying you went about your school. I went to Central Connecticut State University, and it was, we didn't have any kind of Gothic buildings or any kind of grotesque like that. And so that's why I love going to these schools and seeing this really deep tradition that they convey.
Yeah, and I think it's very effective. Very effective. I mean, I didn't know much about it until our two discussions and looking at your books, but it makes me want to go see them myself, although it's way easier just to look at this book.
And some of those, I had a pretty powerful lens. Some of those are pretty high. Right.
Yeah, I figured as much. I figured a lot of these would be really out of the way. And some of them are tucked into niches. Some of these are tucked away in places you wouldn't even see them necessarily.
Monster Talk.
This episode of Monster Talk is brought to you by Audible. Audible is offering Monster Talk listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audibletrial.com/monstertalk. Browse through their unmatched collection of titles, select one, and download it. It's that easy. That's audibletrial.com/monstertalk. When I decided to run ads for Monster Talk, going with Audible was the easiest choice because I've used it for so long. I've been an Audible member since 2003, and I listen to it all the time. I use Audible to prepare for many episodes of the show. Many of the books that we talk about on Monster Talk are available as Audible selections. My pick for this month is The Frighteners by Peter Laws. We will be talking to Peter Laws this month about this fascinating look at the ways in which horror and spooky culture can be helpful or even therapeutic, while still causing some people to give us disapproving stares. With Audible, I was able to listen to The Frighteners while I did chores, mowed the grass, and shopped for groceries. I can move seamlessly from my phone to my tablet to my computer, and Audible keeps up with my progress. You can select any of Audible's titles when you sign up for your 30-day trial membership at audibletrial.com/monstertalk. But I'm happy to make Peter Law's book, The Frighteners, my suggestion for this month. To download your free audiobook while also supporting our show, just go to audibletrial.com/monstertalk and sign up today. That's audibletrial.com/monstertalk.
Monster Talk.
How long did you spend on these campuses to collect these photos?
Well, for a campus like Yale, I lived just in the next town, so I could always just go whenever I had time. But when you're talking about like University of Chicago or Washington University in St. Louis, I was kind of limited the amount of time I could spend there. So I spent, I don't know, about 4 or 5 days or so. I always planned to go in the winter or early spring, because I knew from my time at Yale, I learned that the leaves cover a lot of these.
Oh, and, yeah.
And so you always have to go when the leaves are off the trees to get all of them. I didn't want to come back and realize that I missed a lot of them.
Right. That makes good sense. And it sounds like you did a lot of investigations on some of the stories and to find the things you needed to take. That's really cool.
When I got in contact with like an archivist, like actually at Duke, before I went, somebody told me that the president, Richard Brodhead, went to Yale. And not only did he get his undergraduate and graduate degrees, he was an English professor and dean of Yale College for many years. He spent a lot of time at Yale. So what I did was I sent him a copy of my Yale book, and I said, I'm coming down to photograph at Duke University. And now, he didn't contact me directly, but he had somebody from the public relations department. And they put me in contact with an archivist there. And they set me up with a lot of old descriptions of all the residential quadrangles there. So a lot of times it worked out.
That is fantastic.
Information.
So cool. My company is that I work for. They're based in Detroit. Detroit has a lot of interesting architecture, I guess, from the between the 30s and the 50s. And some of that incorporates the same kind of stuff. And the Detroit Free Press Building has around its exterior all of these really interesting, I would say they're also qualified as grotesques, built into the just above, maybe like below the second story, above the first, in that sort of mezzanine type level on the exterior of the building. And they recently vacated that building. And I hope that something good happens to it. But it's just got these amazing pictures of various sort of historical events or concepts of transportation and airplanes. But done in stone. That whole city is just full of astonishing architecture. I mean, that's not my... I appreciate it, but I know almost nothing about it. But I still, when I have time, I like to go wander around, even in the business districts. You can kind of get the impression, because there was a time when Detroit was an absolutely stunning, active, vibrant industrial center. And it's going through kind of a comeback now, which is awesome. But I would have loved to have seen it at its height. You know, it's kind of like seeing some striking person in an old folks home, they must have been amazing.
Like that when.
Yeah. And that's how I feel. It'll bounce back. It's doing pretty well. But I just love all those remnants of those glory days, you know, stuck around there. It's really neat. And that's also, we don't know, but, you know, 200 years from now, those buildings will be really old, you know. All those campus photos will be, you know, digital, but the gravitas that they attempt now will be legit in a couple of hundred years, and unless something bad happens, they'll still be there. That's amazing.
They put a lot of, I call them aging techniques, into the buildings to make you think that they're older than they actually are.
Yeah, it's like fake ID cards.
And the funny thing is, when I tell people that, a small percentage of people take it personally and get personally insulted. And they think that, oh, this school is trying to dupe me. Well, it really isn't. I don't see it that way. These buildings are very theatrical.
Yes.
You can easily go and find what they're not hiding when the building was constructed. Or you can easily find, you know, the history of the building and when it was constructed. They're not hiding anything, but it's just part of the theatricality of the campus. Like, and I always compare it to like Disney World in Florida. Nobody actually believes that a medieval people came during the medieval period and constructed a castle in a Florida swamp.
Right.
And then some pirates and some retro futurists and ex-presidents took up residence there.
And that's when they built a great railroad around it, right?
Yeah. But you go down there and you have fun just the same.
Yeah. And there's also something, there's this whole field of, I think it's called semiotics, which is about signaling. And that we, as humans, we signal each other all the time. And when you around the house, you dress one way. When you're going shopping, you might dress another.
And you're not really conscious of it.
Right. But when you go to a business interview, you're trying to present a particular side of yourself. You're not trying to pretend to be somebody you're not, hopefully. But you're trying to pretend to be, look at me, I'm competent. And that starts with my clothes.
Yeah, you're trying to say something about yourself.
Yeah. And so I imagine that architecture there not only brings them into mind of age, stability, venerability, but also the sort of reverence of academia that they would expect the students to have. I imagine it has an interesting effect that it would automatically put you inspired to be, I'm on a campus right now, that I'm about to learn something, you know, and I'm part of a long tradition of learning things. So,
I mean, there are times whenever I just want to go and, you know, think about a project or something, I go to Yale and go to Sterling Memorial Library there just because it's like a Gothic cathedral inside and out.
Yeah.
And it's just basically inspiring. And with all these aging techniques that I was talking about, they're meant to work on you on a almost subliminal unconscious level. And you're just supposed to draw the conclusion unconsciously that these buildings are pretty darn old. You don't know really how old, but older than any other man-made structure nearby.
Yeah. And especially the libraries. That for me, libraries are my church, you know. I feel so awed at the scope of humans reaching out, trying to share their ideas and concepts. You know, all those voices bound in paper. It's just so touching.
Wow, you're poetic like that.
Oh, well. Well, and look, and surrounded by all the imagery that you've captured. So it's all good.
Yeah, it's very strange. When you go to a library like Sterling, which is, I said, like a Gothic cathedral inside and out,
Yeah. If
you take a certain turn, maybe to go to they have certain areas that just for staff, and a couple times like the door was left open. I look inside and it's all just tile. It's a totally different aesthetic.
Oh,
or they renovated part of the building and made it very modern. And it's very jarring, actually.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, it's like a backwards Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. You go from this fantasy world into the modernity, right? So
yeah.
Well, Matthew, thank you so much for coming back to talk to us again.
I know you like, you're a big fan of puns.
I am.
Well,
Which I've done almost none of in this interview. I think Karen gives me the slack I need to be thinking about puns. I'm having to do. I'm staying focused here. So, yeah.
So there's this one of the PUNs at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, is one of the chapel's primary donor was William Mather. Now he's a descendant of Cotton Mather, who came over in the Mayflower in colonial America, and for his pew end, he was descended from the Mathews who came over in the Mayflower. So
Right. His
pew end shows in the foreground, it shows like a preacher. They're on the kind of beach in Massachusetts, and there's all the Mathews, and they're kneeling in prayer. They're thanking God for their safe journey to the new world, and see a preacher. And in the background, you see the Mayflower at anchor. Well, in the middle ground, you see these two figures, and it's really small. You have to look closely, and one of them is a settler with a gun, and he's chasing a Native American. And that was based on a pun that William Mather once told. He said that that my family is the sort who, when they first came to the New World, they fell upon their knees in prayer, and then they fell upon the Aborigines.
Oh, wow. That's pretty good.
Very un-PC. This was in the 30s, yes.
It was Cotton and Increase Mather were both heavily involved and blamed for the Salem witchcraft trials. So
yes, I knew they were involved.
Yeah, absolutely involved, and Cotton Mather in particular, and Increase. But that's a great pun, and it's insightful and damning at the same time. So I like that. Well, I think we already asked you what your favorite monster was. Do you have any?
Yeah, Loch Ness Monster.
Yeah, and that's – and we'll probably be doing more coverage of that. You know, since we talked, I got to talk to a guy who did a environmental DNA study of Loch Ness, and I'm really anxious to hear what he found. I don't think he found Nessie, but I'm sure they found some interesting stuff because they basically collected water from all these different depths of the water in the loch. And then from there, they can take all those water samples and run through and sort of collect all the DNA from the animals and life forms living at those different layers of the lake.
Okay, and actually identify them?
Yeah, isn't that amazing? So just they can filter them out and run them through the gene bank and find out precisely what's in there. And if there's new stuff, they can help identify it. So, I mean, it's anytime you go and do a deep study of a new environment, you're likely to find new species just because life's really varied way more than we have investigated. So, but what they do is they take the DNA and then they can look at it and see what it's related to and, you know, kind of to figure out
if it's a family tree.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like molecular phylogeny, I think is what it's called. If it's not, that sounded pretty cool anyway. Or like I need to clear
that was very technical.
Yeah. So, again, thank you so much for coming back to talk to us. And I'll As always, this was great talking to you, and the book is fabulous, and I look forward to getting a hard copy for my wife to steal.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith. You've been listening to an interview with author and photographer Matthew Duman. A link to his newest book, The Grotesque Ten, will be in the show notes. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk will be back with episode 199 on Ouija boards. Stay tuned for more big announcements with episode 200. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thank you so much for listening and for your incredible support.
Been a Monster House presentation.